This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the second week of April, and this week the president fired the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen. He also withdrew his pick to run Customs and Immigration. News stories say President Trump is frustrated by his appointee's failure to stop the surge of families and asylum seekers entering the United States. While the level of total unauthorized border crossings is not unprecedented, the level of crossings by families appears to be. And because of the government's limited ability to detain, rapidly deport, or adjudicate families and asylum seekers, the crisis at the border continues to escalate. The power struggle within the Trump administration over immigration also appears to be dialing back up the White House leak wars. For example, the Washington Post reported this week the White House twice proposed to release detainees in small and mid-sized cities with sanctuary policies, an effort to use human beings to troll the libs. Immigration and Customs Enforcement pushed back forcefully on this idea, citing liability, budgetary, and public relations concerns. Later in the show, an immigration policy expert at the Libertarian Cato Institute will join us to discuss the border situation and why he thinks our borders should be much more open. And it's tax filing season. Vanessa Williamson of the Tax Policy Center will join us to discuss how the public feels about taxes and how Republicans change their taxes. We'll also look at some Democratic proposals about taxes and at congressional Democrats' efforts to obtain Donald Trump's taxes. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the Washington Post. Hi, Rich and Liz.
Hey.
Hey, Josh.
So, Rich, what was your top story this week?
Well, we learned that people don't like the word spy, especially when it's used by Attorney General Bill Barr regarding the Russia investigation and some Trump campaign officials or former campaign officials that were caught up in it. This seems to me somewhat ridiculous controversy. The word spy, it's a pejorative way to say surveil, but it basically means the same thing. And what Attorney General Barr was getting at, as he clarified in the course of this hearing where he said this stuff, is that he wants to know whether the surveillance of the Trump officials was properly predicated. And I think that's an entirely legitimate matter to look into. The Mueller investigation was a national trauma for two solid years. So we should be willing to find out and release various documents that get to what were the roots of this and how it was conducted.
So, Liz, I feel like the question here, as with so much of this, is the level of faith that people have both in the Department of Justice as a whole and in individual political appointees at the Department of Justice like Bill Barr to be honest brokers. I mean, the broad question of, you know, is the government engaging in surveillance for good reasons seems like a perfectly valid question in general. The question is, you know, you have the president out there who will call anything a witch hunt, regardless of whether or not it is, basically pushing this narrative and pushing for this investigation. I think people wonder, is it going to be a fair look at whether the FBI and others did their job well?
Right. I think that you can call Trump, for a lot of reasons, the disenchantment president, right? The way he ran for president was to say, I've bought all these people off over the years. They're all suborned. I'm the only one who can be honest because I have my own money. And while that's not 100% true, it's like 90% true. And I think another thing he's accidentally exposed is something the left has been arguing for a long time, which is that these giant unaccountable government agencies like the FBI are not honest brokers. They're not neutral pursuers of justice. They have their own internal politics and agendas, and they're not really accountable to anyone. So if people have begun to doubt whether they're going to serve their purpose as honest brokers, I think that's probably a good thing, even though it does introduce quite a bit of missing confidence into the public.
Rich, Ken White and I did a special taping of all the president's lawyers this week at the University of Southern California Law School, and we were joined by Orrin Kerr, who's a leading expert on the Fourth Amendment, a contributor to the Volokh conspiracy blog. And a point that he made about this is that he feels like there's been a certain amount of confusion about when an investigation is appropriate. That, you know, basically, if you have an investigation and at the end it doesn't find criminal wrongdoing, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't have been the investigation. The bar, in order to investigate someone or even to surveil them, is a much lower bar than the bar to convict them, because the government needs to conduct investigations to figure out whether people committed crimes. And also, in this instance, needs to conduct investigations for counterintelligence purposes. And so we're never going to know publicly what all the counterintelligence findings of the Mueller investigation were, because they are, many of them are, for good reasons, classified. It seems like the political assumption being driven by Donald Trump here is basically like they didn't find collusion, and therefore the investigation itself was inherently inappropriate.
Yeah, that's true. I take all that. And There are definitely, there's a question in my mind. So to what extent were these FBI officials like legitimately freaked out about various connections and the way Trump talked about Vladimir Putin? And to what extent was it sort of an amateurish reaction? And what extent was it driven by partisan malice? And I just go back to Carter Page, and we'll learn more about Carter Page when the full Mueller report is released. But he was thought to be at the very center of this, and the FISA application, you know, to get the warrant was on Carter Page. And that application said they believed that he was coordinating this interference campaign with the Russians. And I think they believe that because of the so-called dossier, which was a garbage document that was created by this ex-British spy from shadowy Russian sources. And I just think that that document distorted media expectations over what was going to be found and even distorted the FBI's understanding. And the FBI did, as far as we know, nothing to verify this document, didn't really fully reveal to the court the sources of it. There's a footnote that if you squint just right, you can conclude that, yes, this is a partisan document that funded by partisans, but they didn't make it very clear. So I would just like – I want to know more about all that. And it doesn't mean that there's a deep state conspiracy. I know a lot of people say that no matter what. But I do think it behooves us to get the facts out about how this happened. And Carter Page might be an oddball with noxious views of Russia, but he can be that and also have had an injustice done to him.
Liz, what story drew your attention this week?
So after several years of hiding in an Ecuadorian embassy, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is under arrest and facing extradition to the United States for prosecution on Obama-era charges. Assange stands accused of all kinds of crimes, but the indictment unsealed against him Thursday charges him with conspiring with Chelsea Manning to crack a government database password. But nobody's really mad about that. They're furious about WikiLeaks' role in 2016 when the website released emails stolen from DNC members which revealed some dirty doings, especially regarding the primaries. For this, Assange was labeled a Putin patsy and a traitor, though what WikiLeaks exposed about American military forces murdering Iraqi civilians was arguably much more damaging. To my mind, the charge of conspiracy against Assange is pretty unconvincing. It's thin. He was in touch with Manning as she shared information with him, which is typical of journalists and sources, and he tried to protect her later on, which again is the norm. Assange didn't follow all industry standards in the publication of the leaks he received, but industry standards are not law. And much of the ire directed at him by powerful people like Chuck Schumer, who tweeted that Assange should be held to account for his meddling in our elections, meaning the publication of the DNC emails, which he's not actually facing any charges for, simply has to do with his role as a publisher of leaks. And that should worry journalists, even though Assange is certainly not a part of the professionalized standard journalism industry. He acted differently than most of us would have, but if he goes down while congressmen applaud the destruction of a leak publisher, it would and should be chilling for us all.
But Liz, I mean, the specific allegation in the indictment is that he agreed to help Chelsea Manning try to hack a password in order to be able to obtain unauthorized access to a government document that was encrypted. And so basically the claim is that he engaged in a conspiracy to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So, I mean, that's more than just unprofessionalism. You can receive stolen documents and publish them. That's not a crime. But if you assist somebody in, you know, trying to crack a password, why isn't that something that Assange should be tried for?
Look at the evidence. Look at what he did in assisting her to crack the password. They were talking about it. He said he'd had no luck.
Right, but you don't have to be successful in order to be engaged in a criminal conspiracy.
Right, but I mean, so we don't even, there's not even really any proof that he was putting a lot of effort into it. He was essentially encouraging her to use her resources to share secrets with him, which you're allowed to do as a journalist. I mean, legally, maybe there are journalists who say they're so upright that they wouldn't even encourage a source who had access to secret documents to get more. But I think most in the heat of the moment would say, yeah, get what you can. I would love to see it. If you've seen that or think it exists, I would love to have some evidence of it. So, I mean, I think the case is thin. And I think furthermore, even if it is a single technical charge, you can see what people who actually have political power are angry at him about. And it's not this potential involvement in a two-person conspiracy to crack a password. It's the fact that he published damaging leaks that were embarrassing for the United States. And that's disturbing.
Rich, the president who was so eager about WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign, and I should note that as I've noted previously on the show, a substantial number of my husband's emails were released in that 2016 DNC hack. So I have an emotional attachment to that. Although I did not care for the WikiLeaks approach, and especially the cables leaks that Manning was behind many years before there was any personal involvement for me. I think the Edward Snowden stuff is a closer call. I don't think that the Manning leaks were well founded as a moral matter, but what do you make of this as a legal indictment of Julian Assange?
Well, first, just on the moral question, I thought he was an anti-American dirtbag with the initial tranche of leaks that he worked with Manning on, and I thought he was an anti-American dirtbag when WikiLeaks was releasing these Democratic emails during the campaign. So I have no use for this guy, and it's been really disturbing how both sides have wanted to lionize him or look past his flaws when his leaks were in their interest or something they supported or his work. So the legal question, the Justice Department is trying to sidestep the First Amendment issue, and they're making this distinction, which I think is a legitimate one, between are we going to prosecute him for being a publisher, which does get into really thin ice, and the question of what's the distinction between him and The Guardian and The New York Times and any other publication that publishes illegally obtained or leaked material all the time, or was he in on the act of theft? And what they're alleging is that he's in on the act of theft. Now, I take Liz's point. We don't know how much, how solid this is. He supposedly helped with trying to crack the password, but it's not clear how serious he was when he did that. So we want to learn more here. But also it's worth remembering the original charge that he was running from and that prompted him to hole up in the Ecuadorian embassy for 7 years was a rape charge. And his running away from this just forestalled that woman, and actually there for a time there are two charges in Sweden, from getting her day in court. So again, this is to me a sign of just the low character of this guy.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, that's one of the other questions here. Sweden, which had basically given up on that extradition attempt related to that rape charge, whether Sweden will now intervene and try to see whether they can try him in advance of the United States trying to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, you have to divide the specific complaint we're making about the prosecution of Assange as a publisher, or at least the persecution of Assange as a publisher in the narrow instance, from the fact that he's an enormous asshole and that everyone has good reasons to hate him. I mean, it's very upsetting when someone who is a horrible person and a bad actor in general happens to do something that triggers serious moral questions about good things. That's the unfortunate situation that he stumbled into. I wouldn't be friends with the guy. I don't think I'd even tweet at him. But he's definitely a guy who has opened up a discussion about the publication of government secrets in a way that I don't think damages democracy. I think it brings citizens a lot closer to understanding what the real activities of their states are. But I think that he's a horrible emblem for a movement.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about immigration. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. The New York Times ran a front-page story this week about the crisis at the border that I think runs counter to a lot of the political narratives you hear from Republicans and from Democrats. The Times says the immigration system may have reached a breaking point. While illegal immigration is not at record levels, the kind of people seeking entry to the United States has changed in a way the government has not been prepared for. The number of people seeking asylum in the U.S. has tripled since 2008. Often, they're coming from Central America as entire families, putting pressure on a system that's not prepared for them. Families can't be humanely detained for an extended period, they usually can't be quickly deported, and when they have asylum claims, it often takes the courts years to adjudicate them. The president's ideas about what to do about this problem are often illegal and or impractical, such as stopping people from applying for asylum or shutting the border altogether. So what else might be done? To discuss that, we're joined now by Alex Narasta. Alex is senior immigration policy analyst at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alex, I want to ask first about this leadership turnover we've been seeing in the last week with Kirstjen Nielsen getting fired from the Department of Homeland Security, the president withdrawing, and another top immigration policy appointee. What is going on here? The impression from the outside seems to be that the president is upset when people tell him that he can't do things, that things are illegal, that he wants to appoint people who will basically do whatever he tells them to do. Is that something that's going to work for him? Is he going to be able to essentially assert more political control over these agencies and get them to disregard laws? And what would that look like?
Well, I think he's certainly moving in that direction, and he probably will eventually find somebody who will go along with that. However, this is when I say thank goodness for the courts in the United States. So anything that they do, anything that DHS does, will be challenged, as many of the actions taken by this administration have been challenged over time. But I want to say something also what's going on here. I don't usually say this about employees at DHS, but I do feel bad for Nielsen in a way, and for her predecessors, and for whoever, and for the people who are following, because their job is essentially an impossible one. They are trying to get in the way of the flow of workers and asylum seekers from Central America to the United States, attracted by prosperity here, and they're trying to stop that international flow, and that is a nearly impossible task. It's very difficult, especially under current laws. So that's basically the only word of sympathy I have for them.
Rich, what do you see as the purpose of these personnel changes? Has the president been badly served by these appointees? Is he going to be able to have a more effective policy if he changes who's in charge?
Well, I think a lot of this, obviously, is she was presiding over this enormous new flow of illegal immigrants at the border, and it was driving Trump crazy. And it's a little bit firing a coach because his team is losing, even if he doesn't have that much to do with it. Plus, I don't think he really liked her very much to begin with, but there are arguments within the administration that more could be done internally and bureaucratically to, at the margins, help the situation. There's a focus on the so-called credible fear interviews, that are the first step of the asylum process, that the migrants from Central America, on average, they pass about 90% of them pass the credible fear interview, although very few of them will actually ultimately get asylum. So the thought is that more can be done to tighten up there. But the basic problem is the laws, and especially the laws and the loopholes around this particular subset of migrants from Central America that are part of family units. You don't see a huge flow from Mexico, in part because, you know, Mexico is in better shape than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but also because these rules and loopholes don't have the perverse effect with Mexican migrants that they do with Central American migrants. So this particular subset of migrants that we basically have to wave into the country and we'll never see again and we'll never deport, and they all know that, and that's why they're coming and reacting rationally to the incentive.
Liz, you get this odd dynamic often with personnel changes in the Trump administration where people on the left will strongly criticize appointees. And I think Kirstjen Nielsen has come in for a tremendous amount of criticism over her handling of the border from the left. And then as soon as they're leaving, I don't think people have changed their mind and decided that they liked Kirstjen Nielsen, but there is a strong element of concern that whoever replaces her could be a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something you always have to have reasonable concerns about when Trump appears to dismiss someone because they won't act illegally or act on whatever sort of authoritarian impulse he's trying to push through the administration. With Kirstjen Nielsen, I mean, it's hardly the case, like you said, that the left has been sympathetic. I think that the left actually has been pretty vocal in calling for her to be, you know, all but blacklisted from any future employment in order to dissuade anyone from taking that position who might come in for similar criticism.
Alex, one story we've seen this week, and it sort of looks like the set of leaks you tend to see after personnel fights within the administration, some embarrassing stories about things the White House has tried to do on immigration. And one was this Washington Post story saying that the White House twice floated this idea that they wanted to take detainees from the border who were being released and send them to sanctuary cities, release them there basically as a political statement or a gotcha against liberals. And it described, to your point about the staff pushback that there was against this. But it also struck me that, you know, this is an overwhelmed government apparatus. And so if they had the sort of resources they would need to basically be busing detainees all over the country to release them in Berkeley or whatever, they would also have a lot of the resources that they would need to be dealing with the crisis that seems to be overwhelming them.
That's probably true. I mean, dollars that can be spent on buses could also be spent on hiring more interviewers or more detention space, etc. But there would require a lot more of that to do it. What I was more disturbed by in that report is that folks in the White House who claim to be, you know, American nationalists looking out for American citizens who think that illegal immigrants are very dangerous want to then bus them to American communities where people vote Democratic and who have sanctuary policies, in part as a gotcha to say we're going to dump a bunch of violent people in those communities as if they really think that they don't matter that much. Now, of course, the evidence is that illegal immigrants have much lower crime rates than native-born Americans do. So from my perspective, I wouldn't be much worried about that. I mean, if they want to send those folks to my community in Northern Virginia, I'd be happy for them to do that. But I think it speaks to sort of a cynicism in this administration and in a meaning of basically the idea that a lot of their fellow citizens in sanctuary cities around the country don't really matter that much and could be used for political purposes.
So then what is your view about how you would deal with this situation? If you have large numbers of people fleeing unrest and violence and poverty in Central America, what should the U.S. government policy be if it's not, you know, trying to reduce that flow?
So I have a sort of a heterodox opinion relative to other pro-immigration folks out there who work on this topic. I think most of the flow is determined by poverty, and I think Rich is correct that a lot of these sort of asylum rules are incentivizing a lot of them to come. But the reason why we got a handle on Mexican illegal immigration was because we massively expanded the number of H-2B and H-2A visas to Mexicans, which are temporary seasonal work permits. So we essentially turned a Mexican illegal migrant flow into a legal worker flow. And so I think the answer going forward to this is not to clamp down on asylum or put more barriers, but to instead try to turn this flow into a legal one by granting more H-2A, H-2B, and other temporary work visas, and hopefully eventually green cards to a lot of these folks. And that way we can get a handle on the black market, we can get a handle on that flow, and we can basically turn it from a very dangerous, illegal one into an open, transparent, and legal one.
Rich, I mean, you point to the experience with Mexico as something of a success over the last couple of decades, and there's an element of what Alex described there. The other thing that you alluded to was significant improvement in the conditions in Mexico, especially economic improvement. You have an administration now that has been withdrawing aid from countries in Central America because the president is upset about the immigration flows. But what's wrong with Alex's prescription there, that basically you would try to normalize some of these population flows, and at the same time you would take efforts that would try to enhance economic development and security in Central America so that fewer people would feel compelled to leave?
Well, I'm all in favor of the latter to the extent we can do it. And I think it's short-sighted and just another symptom of the present kind of flailing around because there's no ready solution at the border to cut off foreign aid to them. But I think the flow of Central American migrants has drastically increased as we've – it's not a natural just economic phenomenon. It's – and if you're going to it's a product of these people getting in and knowing they can get in. So if you stop that, the flow would at least diminish. But if you're just going to say whoever comes, we're going to find a way to find a legal manner for them to come in, you wouldn't be at 100,000 a month. You'd be much higher than that. You'd be removing basically all risks that you might not get in and making it much easier. And everyone coming from Central America, they know their lives will be better in the United States. And the question is, so it's good for them. The question is whether it's good for us. And I don't like people who depict these immigrants as budding criminals. I mean, they're people who do come here. They'll take jobs. They'll want to work. but is it really good for us to increase our population of people without high school diplomas when we already have a lot of people without high school diplomas in the country who are struggling? So why would we deliberately go out of the way to increase and flood that part of the labor market? That makes zero sense to me.
Liz, every so often, Bernie Sanders will make a comment about immigration that will get discussed in the media sort of as though it were a new conservative position, when it's in fact, I believe, basically his consistent position for decades, which is acknowledging a trade-off between domestic job market and fiscal priorities and the level of immigration. See, you know, he will say open borders is a Koch brothers proposal. I strongly suspect that you, Liz, favor a higher level of total immigration than Rich does, that Bernie would favor a higher level of immigration than Rich does, but is that a real concern for people on the left, that there's a limit to the sort of the practical amount of immigration that the U.S. can handle, and what is that practical limit?
I mean, I think that's the debate, right? So you have different points of view on the left, as you know, any political strata, and some people on the left do favor something like an open borders proposal. Even that open borders point of view has a mix of positions within it, with some people favoring sort of unlimited citizenship and some people favoring sort of work certifications and registry, and others having a totally different approach. And then you have other people on the left who do think, well, right, there's a rate at which immigration should occur. It's a much higher rate than Republicans are proposing. But it is a rate that does have a limit. And that number is where the debate occurs. And so far as Bernie is concerned, I mean, he doesn't favor open borders. That's essentially what he said last week, I believe. But there is no Democrat running that I know of who is actually proposing open borders.
Alex, do you see a practical limit to the amount of immigration the United States can allow if we basically went to, you know, to people in Central America and said, if you want to come work here, go ahead, you know, come and do so? Is there a practical limit to what we should allow?
I think there is a limit, but I think these limits are determined more by the demand for these folks in the United States, for perhaps their impact on culture and institutions in the United States, etc. I don't think it's quite a limit that can really be debated or measured ex ante in the halls of Congress, but in the same way that there's practical limits between how many people can move from California to Nevada or how many people can move from California to Virginia like I did, I don't think that's really a number that can be determined rationally, in the same sense that the amount of steel that can be made in the United States can be determined ex ante by a government planning board. I don't think that we can determine the optimal number of people that should be here or that should immigrate here to the United States either.
I'm sorry. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that, you know, that a limited number of people would actually immigrate, which is surely true. The question is, should there be a policy limit on that? I mean, because that's how immigration policy is built now. There are effective limits on how many visas and given categories can be issued over a given period. Should there be such limits, or should it be unlimited?
Well, I think the limit should be on quality rather than quantity. So these should be very harsh limits on trying to stop, say, criminals, people with serious communicable diseases, national security threats, and maybe some limits in terms of education or other such things, but not really a hard number limit. I mean, one of the other proposals I like out there is put forward by Gary Becker, the late Nobel Prize winning economist. The idea that you basically have a tariff. You have an unlimited number of visas, but you charge a price for them. And you let those, you let sort of the market figure out the right quantity. I think that's a very good sort of middle ground proposal, where a lot of revenue could be raised for the federal government, as well as having a more market-sensitive and driven immigration system. I mean, the current one is basically like a centrally planned mechanism where we determine that Congress somehow has the knowledge and incentives to determine the right number of immigrants coming in. And I think that's not a very good, not a very efficient system. We should rely more on market forces and voluntary decisions rather than those determined centrally in D.C.
I'd like to hear from both Rich and Liz on that, because that sounds like a system that's very focused around the needs of employers. And I imagine that both of you might take issue from that with one direction or another.
Yeah, so this would be a prescription for massive amounts of more low-skilled immigration, because the people that have the highest incentive to come here would be the world's poor, and employers would be happy to have them because it would depress wages and give them more low-wage workers. And just the question is whether that's actually good for us as a country and good for workers, both native workers and legal immigrant workers who are already here? And I think the answer is no. And people aren't products in the same way, you know, getting an iPhone from China or wherever is. I mean, they have a cultural effect. They, you know, consume healthcare. They go to schools. So it's a question just beyond the sheer economics of it. And I would oppose it even on economic grounds, because I think the lower end, lower skill workers in this country have had a really hard time, at least over the last two decades. And I would like to see a really tight labor market for a long stretch of time to try to make up for the ground that's been lost. And this proposal would give us exactly the opposite, make the problem worse.
Well, it seems like a market-based approach to immigration would allow businesses to essentially purchase visas and distribute them to workers they know they can pay much less or refuse benefits and so forth. I also think that one of the issues with a market-based approach to immigration is sometimes the people who most need to come to the United States, refugees, for example, cannot afford, you know, or could not conceivably afford a visa. So in evaluating who we really need to take in as they flee violence, conflict, and war, I don't think price should factor into that.
When we talk about visas for lower-skilled workers, the government has actually just recently increased the cap on H-2B visas. These are the sort of temporary visas for people who work at ski resorts and golf courses, including some of the president's properties. Rich, is there a policy rationale for this? It seems completely counter to the president's political rhetoric about immigration and the labor market. But when people ask him specifically about his golf courses, his answer is basically, well, you can't get people who are from the United States to work in those jobs, which seems like an argument that immigration restrictionists reject as applied to other industries.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to the tension we've talked about a lot between Trump's deep-set personal views on this and what's supposed to be his official view, which is supposed to favor lower levels of legal immigration. But every time he goes off script or is just talking on his own, he talks about higher levels and specifically the need for more of these sort of workers. And I just believe, I believe in markets. I believe that markets clear and that if it's hard to hire someone, you pay more for the position, and eventually it will be filled. But employers, understandably, they don't want to pay more, and they prefer to import lower wage labor. So that's just been the constant drumbeat from corporate America and employers, and it's almost always been satisfied. And unfortunately, this administration seems willing to satisfy it as well.
Alex, as a person who's a proponent of a much more open immigration policy, what do you make of the politics of the last 20 years? Which is to say, I feel like there's been confidence from advocates of immigration reform that there is broad popular support for the idea that the U.S. should be broadly an open country that admits a lot of immigrants, that the U.S. should regularize the status of the large number of unauthorized immigrants who've been living in the U.S. for many years. And yet that continues to not happen, and you had a presidential election that was won, albeit not with a plurality of the popular vote, but with 46% of the national vote, by a candidate who really ran first and foremost on immigration restriction. Are the people with you on this? And if so, when are you going to get your way?
Well, they are moving more and more in this direction. If you take a look at Gallup polls on this question, they've polled on this since the mid-1960s. They ask if you want they ask Americans if they want more immigration, less immigration, or about the same. In the mid-1990s, two-thirds of respondents wanted less immigration. Only 7% wanted more immigration. In the last round of the survey in 2018, the numbers were tied. About 31% wanted less and 30% wanted more. Meanwhile, the number who wanted about the same level of immigration stayed about the same. So if I'm just taking a look at those numbers, taking a look at those trends, I'm very bullish on the position that the pro-immigration side in the electorate is increasing and getting much more power, while the side that is opposed to immigration, that wants to cut immigration, is diminishing in support. And what's interesting, these numbers went up after Trump was elected. What I will say, though, is that folks who are pro-immigration, it's generally not their number one issue. It's not what gets them out the vote. While I think you have a sort of an issue with people who are opposed to immigration, it's like one of their number one top issues. They go out and vote for it. So you have sort of so I think in the future what you'll see is the majority of Americans will support more immigration, and a minority will want to cut it, but that minority will be much louder, much more influential, because they'll actually change their votes based on the issue, while my side probably won't.
We're going to leave that there. Alex Narasta is Senior Immigration Policy Analyst at the Cato Institute. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig, what's your Tweet of the Week?
This week, the Event Horizon Telescope tweeted, "Scientists have obtained the first image of a black hole using Event Horizon Telescope observations of the center of the galaxy M87. The image shows a bright ring formed as light bends in the intense gravity around a black hole that is 6.5 billion times more massive than the sun." And that does distill the spirit of the week.
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is about Lori Loughlin, one of the parents and celebrities caught up in the college admissions scandal, and her Hallmark show has been re-editing old episodes to remove her from the program. And Yasha Munk tweets, "The behavior of the parents involved in the college admissions scandal was absolutely vile, but airbrushing an actress out of a television show because she participated in the bribery scheme is completely ridiculous."
My Tweet of the Week is actually a tweet storm from Matt Iglesias of Vox. There is this sort of bizarre fake tournament bracket that is done once a year by the neoliberal account on Twitter, naming the top neoliberal shill in the world on Twitter. And Matt won that this year. And so one of his projects is to convince people that Bernie Sanders is actually a good candidate for neoliberal shills. And so Matt has an interesting tweet storm about Bernie's record as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, calling Bernie a centrist who constrained property taxes and cut wasteful spending, even engaged in public-private partnerships. That's a fun bit of trolling. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Vanessa Williamson of the Brookings Institution to talk about taxes. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist of The Washington Post. It's tax time. Tax filings are due on Monday, April 15, and a lot of people are complaining about nasty surprises, refunds lower than they expected, or even owing money to the government. Of course, that happens to a lot of people every year, even when the tax law doesn't change, and these perceptions also have a way of aligning with our political views. If you like Donald Trump, you're more likely to think he gave you a tax cut. According to the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, only about 6% of tax filers are paying more taxes this year as a result of the tax law. The vast majority are getting a tax cut. To talk about taxes and our feelings, we're joined now by Vanessa Williamson. Vanessa is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center. She's the author of the book, Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Hello, Vanessa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is your sense of what's going on with refunds here? There's this narrative that basically the administration would reduce tax withholding too much. They wanted people to feel this bump in their paychecks, and that's turned into smaller refunds and more people owing taxes. Is that showing up in the data?
Yeah, so I think that there are a couple of things going on. First of all, most of the tax cuts were pretty small for the majority of Americans. I mean, obviously not at the top end, but for a lot of people, especially if your wages vary because you have different hours or other pieces are moving in your work life, you're unlikely to necessarily have seen the changes. In addition, of course, the government was shut down and the IRS got behind. So there were a lot of things that made this tax year a little bit more confusing than usual.
And so how is that playing into public opinion more broadly? When the tax law passed, the polls did not look very good for it. As people are filing their taxes, are they starting to feel more positively about it?
Well, one of the things that's happening is that a tax law that was actually strikingly unpopular when it passed, it was less popular than any number of recent tax increases at a federal level, which was unusual, has simply kind of faded from the American mind. So fewer people actually have strong opinions about it. And by and large, people don't really remember that much about it or notice the tax cuts that they received.
So, Rich, there had been an idea for Republicans running in 2018 that the tax law would be central to their campaign, and you saw a lot of campaigns moving away from that messaging, that their consultants or whoever did not think it was connecting. They focused more on immigration. What is the political hope from Republicans in the long run for this tax cut?
There wasn't a huge demand for it in the first place, and as Vanessa points out, it sort of faded as an issue, and certainly saw that in the campaigns where even Republicans who were desperate to run on economic issues just realized it's just that the tax cut itself just wasn't that big a deal and wasn't cutting for them. I mean, the long-term case for the economic effect of the tax cut is that the corporate reforms will incentivize investment and that will increase the productivity of the American economy over time. But that effect would take time to happen. There'd be all sorts of intervening events. It'd be hard to point specifically back to the tax law for causing anything that happened, you know, 4 or 5 years later. So politically, I just don't think it's going to have a huge effect one way or the other. It'll be, you know, it helps Trump with Republicans because he can say, look, I cut taxes the way Republicans always do, and I pass these corporate reforms we've wanted for a long time, and that have all things being equal, a good effect on the economy. But in terms of his salesmanship in 2020, it'll be pretty far down the list, I think.
Vanessa, your book, right in the title, says that people are proud to pay taxes. I think people have this sense politically that taxes are, you know, something obviously that's unpopular, and especially proposing to increase them is unpopular. What's the argument about Americans feeling proud to pay taxes?
Well, I think if you think more historically about it, it's been very common for people to use their status as taxpayers to demand representation in government, right? That's part of the founding myth of America. It's something you see all throughout our history. When women and African Americans sought suffrage, they often described themselves as people who paid taxes and therefore people deserving of representation. In the current moment, I think that it's really overstated the idea that taxpaying is unpopular. Being proud of something, it doesn't mean that you're happy, but people do see taxpaying as an important civic responsibility. In fact, the rate at which people say that is extraordinary. It's almost a consensus. So if you ask people, do you think it's every American's civic responsibility to pay their fair share of taxes, you get something like 90%+ approval, which is almost unheard of. So people really do see taxpaying as part of being a good citizen.
Liz, do you see that folding into the Democratic Party internal conversation on taxes at this point? Because I'm struck, you know, you have this new fashion for modern monetary theory, which is this sort of esoteric economic theory. But part of the reason it's come into fashion is that it allows you to make arguments that say we can greatly increase government spending and we may not actually need to raise taxes in order to do that. Is the environment more hospitable than people thought to go out there and say, you know, here we want a more active government and we're going to tax you more to pay for that and it's going to be worth it?
Well, I think modern monetary theory allows you to make any argument. Some MMT people say, you know, we don't need to raise taxes. That's the beauty of it. And then some come back and say, but we absolutely will, you know, just to reduce inequality, essentially, and cripple the power of the super rich. So you can have it any which way in modern monetary theory, which is a little disturbing to me. But I think that the Democratic Party, in maybe small ways, at least the progressive wing, is certainly warming up to the idea that taxes are worth it, especially when they go into these universal programs that improve quality of life, reduce inequality across the board. At the same time, you still get really dispiriting activity like the Working Families Tax Relief Act, which, you know, aims to reduce tax burdens on poorer families by using tax credits, but it still phases them in ways that actually disadvantage the very poorest people, especially the poorest children. So there's a lot of work left to be done there.
Vanessa, what do you get of the sort of menu of tax options that are being put out by Democrats? We've seen in the past week the single-payer bill that Democrats are looking at in Congress. Actually, they're calling it a menu of tax possibilities, including a new 4% payroll tax and then a number of new taxes that would apply to high earners and to corporations. At the same time, Kamala Harris is running for president on a large new tax credit for middle-income families that would be a large tax cut. Do you see the proposals that are out there sort of adding up in line with the spending that's also being proposed?
Well, I think that the really important question is what these tax proposals are saying about how we're explaining the economy, right? I think if you're putting forward proposals that are about raising taxes on the very wealthiest, you know, as Liz Bundick suggested, that's an argument about inequality being unfair and being a danger to our political system, right? And at the same time, you can also be supporting policies that direct more income to the poorest among us, right? So it's not that these policies are necessarily in conflict. They're just telling a little bit of a different story, I think, about why we ended up with the inequality we have today. Is the problem that people at the bottom just for some reason can't get ahead? Or is the problem that the people at the top have too much?
Well, but so I find that to be a little bit of a confused thing, talking about, you know, are taxes for reducing inequality or are they for financing government? Because in most cases, they should be effective at both, unless they do so much to discourage income that they actually don't raise a lot of revenue. But so it seems to me that implicit in a lot of the tax conversation from the left has been the idea that the government should be larger and that only rich people, however defined, ought to pay for that, whether that's, you know, people making over $200,000, as was the barrier that that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton would typically use in discussing tax proposals. We've moved a little bit away from that. But it seems like that conversation has been mostly about the idea that taxes are for financing government and an implicit claim that you can raise enough revenue to finance the desired expansion of government by taxing only a limited subset of the public. Which also seems to go against what you're discussing about taxes as a civic responsibility, that if it's a civic responsibility, that it's then a little odd that the financing package only applies to a small slice of the population.
I think if Democrats wanted to think about the political impacts of taxation, they would see payroll taxes as maybe a little more progressive than they otherwise would imagine. If you want to look at some of the largest and most significant social safety net programs the United States has, Medicare and Social Security, those programs are payroll tax funded and always have been, and FDR made the case for the payroll tax as a way of creating a moral right to the benefits that those programs provided. So if we think that in at least some cases, broad-based taxation creates a constituency that will protect a large social safety net, it may have values that have nothing to do with the revenue it raises so much as the political implications that result.
Rich, the IRS has been in the news this week because of the request from the Democrats who run the House Ways and Means Committee to obtain President Trump's tax returns, and it appears that the Trump administration intends to seek to resist this request, even though the request comes under a law that would appear to allow Congress to obtain any person's tax returns for an investigative purpose. Is the president on good grounds to be trying to withhold his taxes?
Well, one, he should release his taxes. I think there's a public interest in seeing his taxes. I doubt there's anything dastardly about his taxes, or we're going to learn, you know, that he's long been a Russian agent or anything of that. They're just going to be embarrassing because he's used every means possible to diminish his liability, and probably a lot of years didn't pay taxes and didn't give a lot to charity and was losing money or not making as much as he said. So that'll all be embarrassing, but I doubt anything beyond that. On the law, the letter of the law seems pretty clear. It seems a terrible law to me, but that, you know, Congress can just request this and see anyone's tax return. Now, the administration is going to argue the Supreme Court has held over the years that there needs to be some legitimate legislative intent behind congressional investigations like this. It'll ultimately end up in the Supreme Court. I don't think we'll get a resolution likely until President Trump's second term, if he's reelected. And there's some chance the court just may kick this can and just say this is a political dispute between the two branches, and we're not going to intervene. But one way or the other, we're not going to see his return soon.
Liz, there was also a dispute among Democrats in the House of Representatives about an issue in an IRS reform bill about whether the IRS should be allowed to develop its own filing system for taxes that would be widely used. There's a lobby from companies like TurboTax that do private tax preparation that would not like to face public competition. And there was an objection from some progressives in the House Democratic Caucus basically saying this is going to entrench that private service that then taxpayers end up having to pay for. Progressives ended up backing down on taking that fight. Do you have a sense of why?
I think that progressives are in a tough position right now. I mean, one thing that House Democrats, Pelosi's side, the sort of center Democrats have shown is that they're not remotely afraid of the Progressive Caucus. They, you know, passed the D-trip, for example, changed their regulations to blacklist vendors that work with primary challengers. And a lot of those challengers are going to be people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, people who are coming from the left in safe blue districts. And obviously, the House was not happy about that. And so they did something about it. I think that more than anything showed that the centrists in the House are not at all worried about progressives. So progressives know they have sort of limited capital and they also have limited power. And so I think it's unfortunate that they didn't pursue this fight to the bitter end. They may have lost. They very well may have. But at least to publicize the fact that the sort of centrist Democrats in the House are taking the side of these private companies that take advantage of taxpayers with basically a compulsory expense.
Vanessa, the response that you got, because this was a bipartisan piece of legislation sponsored by some quite progressive Democrats, including John Lewis, and they were contending essentially that people are just misunderstanding the law and that it does not actually impose new restrictions on the IRS and what it can offer in terms of filing. What's the truth here?
So I think that, yeah, there has been a lot of confusion on this. And one of the things that's worth thinking about is the IRS doesn't currently provide pre-populated tax forms, for instance, and would basically require legislation to do it anyway. So it's not, it doesn't, I think, make the lift that much higher in the future to put in place a much more sensible system that involves the government helping to calculate your taxes as they do in most countries. More generally, I think that the real challenge is that we haven't set up a good system for low-income people to be able to get their taxes filed for free. We've set up a sort of public-private partnership that's vastly underutilized and really leaves a lot of people in the lurch, leaves a lot of people paying more than they should by law to get their taxes filed.
Rich, my sense is that a certain amount of the resistance to pre-populated, easy-to-file taxes, where basically the government would take what it knows from W-2 forms from your employer and that sort of thing and send you what it thinks your 1040 form ought to look like, rather than you having to fill it out or pay for a service that will fill it out for you, is that conservatives want people to go through the experience of paying taxes, to think about what they're having to pay. They want it to be a little bit unpleasant because they think that makes people more resistant to taxes. Is that an unfair characterization?
No, that's totally fair. We don't even like withholding as it exists now. So
Milton Friedman came up with withholding.
Well, Milton Friedman nods. We prefer that people have a full view of how much is being taken from them by the government. And I take Vanessa's point, you know, from earlier, that people consider, you know, filing their taxes and doing it honestly a civic duty. That doesn't mean they like taxes. Especially, it doesn't mean that they would like having their taxes increased. And I think this is the fantasy of so many of these progressive plans that are being advanced now. They're either not funded, or there's the hope that they can be entirely funded by taxing the rich in this country even more. And it's just not true. If you really want to support a European-style welfare state, you're going to have to, European-style, go further down the income ladder and get the money from the middle class. And as soon as you do that, the theoretical support for higher taxes will evaporate.
We're going to leave it there on taxes. Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The chicken sandwich restaurant Chick-fil-A has been excluded from two airports in the last couple of weeks because it stands accused of giving donations to allegedly anti-LGBT groups like the Salvation Army. Yes, the Salvation Army that raises $2 billion a year from private sources and supports all sorts of programs like disaster relief and Christmas gifts for needy children. This is a vindictive and anti-constitutional campaign, and Chick-fil-A's critics don't necessarily need to eat more chicken, but they should leave the restaurant chain alone.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
So Bernie made $1 million on his book, and that translated into a lot of news declaring Bernie Sanders is a lying hypocrite. He's a millionaire. How can you be a yacht communist, as they say, the answer to a limousine liberal? And the answer is that there are a lot of socialists who are pretty well-to-do. FDR himself was an aristocrat. But I would take it easy on Bernie for this reason. He would support raising his own taxes in this instance. So the best way to deal with him if you're upset about him having made $1 million on a book in his 70s is just to vote for him and put him in office.
For my rant, we've had another round in the cultural fight over Starbucks, and particularly whether Starbucks is a waste of money. The finance guru Susie Orman said that buying Starbucks is like pouring money down a drain. If you stop buying specialty coffee every day and instead save the money in a Roth IRA, you would have about $1 million at retirement, which is an exaggeration, but the number, even assuming a reasonable rate of return, a few hundred thousand dollars, is substantial. On the other hand, what point is there of earning money but to spend it? People buy Starbucks because they like it, and if specialty coffee makes you happy, then go ahead, buy your Starbucks. That's what you made the money for. On the other hand, I still want to stick up for Susie Orman, because a lot of people find advice like this useful. She has a lot of followers. Dave Ramsey has a lot of followers. They give advice to people who are looking for ways to spend less and save more in their lives. And if simple rules like stop buying Starbucks work for you, maybe because you don't like specialty coffee that much, that's fine too. An advisory relationship has two sides. Just because somebody's out there giving advice that isn't good for you, that doesn't mean the advice isn't good for someone. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Alex Narasta, and Vanessa Williamson. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.